That's the wrong question. It assumes you want to wait till the last possible minute. In fact, you want to do it right away if you can. Even if you just missed the deadline for this tax year, that just means you're getting the earliest possible start for next year. Interestingly, if two people each contributed $5,000 a year to an IRA for 25 years, earning 7%, but one contributed on January 2nd each tax year, the earliest possible moment, and the other waited until April 15th of the following year, the last possible moment, each would have contributed $125,000 in total over those 25 years. But the one who got the early start would have seen his or her money grow by an extra $30,000 or so, because it would have had longer to compound. What about non-deductible retirement plan contributions? Many people have the opportunity to put extra, non-deductible money into their employer's retirement plan, or to put money into an IRA even though they won't qualify for the tax deduction. When you do this, you shelter the growth of the money from taxes until withdrawn, and then only that growth is taxed when it is withdrawn. Not bad, but a Roth IRA is better if you qualify. What's more, refer to the section on stocks at the end of this chapter. What about early withdrawals? Among the other advantages of a Roth IRA is the ability to withdraw contributions, not appreciation, but the money you actually contributed, free of tax or penalty at any time. But this is a weak advantage at best, since the whole point is to keep as much money growing tax-free as you can. Think hard before withdrawing money from a Roth IRA or from a traditional IRA for the down payment on a first home or to pay catastrophic medical expenses or college costs. It should be done only as a last resort, since money withdrawn for these purposes cannot later be returned to the tax shelter. Better to borrow from your retirement plan at work, if possible, and then repay the loan as quickly as you can. What about converting my existing IRA to a Roth? It's as simple as filling out a little paperwork with the custodian of your current IRA. You will have to pay tax on every penny you convert, except pennies that were contributed non-deductibly. But for someone with just a little saved up in an IRA, conversion is all but irresistible. She'd pay just a little tax, and from then on, all growth would be tax-exempt forever. On the other hand, someone with a large IRA would have to think twice. Making such a big conversion would put her in a high tax bracket if she were not already in one. And using some of the money in the IRA to pay the large tax bill would be a bad idea, because she'd be reducing the size of her tax-sheltered fund. One possibility, set up a Roth IRA and convert just a manageable portion each year, particularly in years when, for whatever reason, your taxable income is low. Traditional IRAs are great, but where you can afford it, paying the tax to convert to a Roth is like kicking in more money for your old age. Further questions? Visit irs.gov/publications/P590A and struggle through it, or ask the retirement expert at your bank, brokerage firm, mutual fund, or employer. Kids and retirement plans. One last note to tie these two together: your kids or grandkids and retirement. Silly as it sounds at first, you might actually want to encourage your 12-year-old to set up a Roth IRA. Not because he will have the vaguest interest in saving for his retirement, but because the power of compound interest is so amazing, and again, because of the saving habit it might help to form. Up to $5,000 a year in wages your child earns may be contributed to an IRA, so long as it's legitimate income, earned either from a family business, he stocks the shelves in your store, or from outside sources like babysitting or lawn mowing, but not sitting your baby or mowing your lawn. It's also legal for you then to give your child enough to replace what she or he has squirreled away in the IRA. Say your 12-year-old earns $20 a week, $1,000, which she puts in an IRA. Say further that you give her an extra $20 a week spending money to make up for what she puts away. That way, she won't mind. What's the point? Well, if she does this for 10 years, through age 22, and if she invests it in an IRA account with a mutual fund that manages to earn 10% a year, then at age 70, don't laugh, that $10,000 you helped her put away would be worth $1.5 million, enough to throw off $180,000 a year for 20 years to age 90. There's no magic to this, just the magic of doing it. How many listeners do you think actually will? And inflation will surely erode the value of that $180,000. But if we average 3% inflation over all those years, it would still be the equivalent of $25,000 or $30,000 a year for 20 years in today's buying power. Not bad for 10 annual contributions of $1,000. How many old folks do you know today who couldn't use a $25,000 a year income boost? My dream, well, one of my dreams, is that long after you and I are gone, there will be comfortably retired 80-year-old guys playing poker saying, "Well, and so my pappy read this little book when I was 12, and, eh? Have I told you this one already?" Don't worry about terrible inflation unraveling this strategy either. If we have an inflationary tidal wave at some point, your child or grandchild would likely do fine. The buying power of bonds would get creamed, but equity mutual funds, with time, would likely bob up on top of the inflation. Why? Because they would own shares in the companies that are raising the prices. Annuities. Annuities are hot because they grow tax-deferred and pay a fat commission to the folks who sell them, which leads to a lot of enthusiastic selling. Don't buy them. Basically, annuities are like giant IRAs with no limit on how much you can contribute, but no tax deduction for making that contribution either. Some annuities promise a fixed return. Increasingly, people are buying variable annuities, where your return depends on how well the insurance company invests your money. It's like investing your IRA in a stock market mutual fund. Since you're likely to hear a lot of reasons why you should buy annuities, here are a few why you should not. Annuity income is fully taxed as you withdraw it. If you're mainly looking for a tax shelter, why not buy tax-free bonds instead? Their interest is never taxed. The alluring rate some annuities promise is generally guaranteed for only 1 year. The projections used to sell them are typically illustrations of what might happen, not what's guaranteed. Once you buy an annuity, your funds are pretty well locked in to age 59 and a half. There's the 10% penalty, as with an IRA, but not the initial tax deduction that makes IRAs attractive, and many annuities impose hefty surrender charges of their own. Since annuities are typically bought for the long term, why not buy stocks instead? Over long periods of time, stocks are almost sure to beat fixed-rate investments. Variable annuities do invest in stocks, but how well? What if the insurance company hires below-average managers? After all, not all money managers are above average. Or what if you want to switch to some other investment manager? At the very least, you would have to hassle with a 1035 exchange, and you might face surrender charges. Even if their investment managers are just as good as anybody else's, most variable annuities will significantly underperform because they are dragged down by heavy sales and overhead costs and by an insurance component that does you little good. In any event, if you're going to invest in stocks, why do it through an annuity? Any gains and dividends you withdraw from an annuity are fully taxed as ordinary income, even if they would have qualified as lightly taxed long-term capital gains and dividends outside the shelter of the annuity. This is true of traditional IRAs, SEPs, and KEO plans too. But with those, you get that initial tax deduction. You are paying big fees to convert low-taxed capital gains and dividends into high-taxed ordinary income. Appreciation within an annuity must eventually be distributed and subjected to income tax when you die, if not before. Under current law, gains outside an annuity escape income tax altogether when you die. Good news for your loved ones. In short, if you were thinking of a fixed-rate annuity, consider tax-free bonds instead. If you were thinking of a variable annuity, buy a stock market index fund. You'll save sales fees and insurance charges. You'll suffer no penalty for early withdrawal. You'll enjoy considerable, albeit different, tax advantages. If you've already bought an annuity, good. It's great that you've put money aside and that it's growing tax-deferred. But with the next chunk of cash you're able to squirrel away, you might be able to do even better. Two exceptions. Teachers at tuition-based institutions have a pretty good deal with TIAA CREF. If you're one of them, you know what I mean. If you're actually interested in buying an annuity, a real one, then go ahead. Long before annuities became highly promoted tax deferral schemes, they were something almost entirely different. An insurance company's promise to pay you a set amount as long as you lived. For an 80-year-old not sure whether he or she will live another 3 years or another 30, it's a way to shift the risk of exceptionally long life onto an insurance company. The insurer can handle this risk because, A, it will assume, in setting its price, that you're likely to live a long time. Cancer patients do not buy annuities. And B, even if you live to 105, enough other annuitants won't. On average, the insurer makes out fine. Annuities are the opposite of life insurance, where insurers suspect all applicants of having hereditary heart disease and the customer wins by dying young. Just be sure, before you plunk down $300,000 for an annuity, that you've shopped aggressively for the best deal. ImmediateAnnuities.com is a good place to start. And that you really want to do this. Once you've bought an annuity, there are no refunds. And be sure to remember that most annuities have no cost of living clause. The $2,000 a month you get may seem sweet indeed for the first few years, but a bad run of inflation could drastically pinch your standard of living. So it could make sense to put a portion of your dough or your grandmother's dough into one of these, but retain flexibility with the rest. Real estate. Real estate you invest in on your own, where you know the area personally, search for your own opportunity, and are intimately involved in structuring the deal and overseeing the property, is far different from the kind of nutty tax shelters referred to at the beginning of this chapter. The tax twist is that you get to depreciate your property even as, in real life, it may be appreciating. Say you buy an 8-unit apartment building down the street in a bank foreclosure for $350,000, of which $275,000 is depreciable, and manage to clear $10,000 a year after all expenses. Because residential property is currently depreciated over 27.5 years, you get to deduct $10,000 a year in depreciation from your rental incomes. So in this example, it's all tax-deferred until you sell. Meanwhile, say the property appreciates at 4% a year. That gain is also shielded from taxes until you sell. When you do sell, you have to pay capital gains tax not only on the 4% annual appreciation, but also, currently at a special 25% rate, on all the accumulated depreciation the IRS recaptures. But no one says you have to sell. You could just keep collecting more and more rent, and perhaps one day borrow more against your now more valuable property to enjoy some of the gain without paying tax on it. These are the basic tax advantages real estate offers, and there is also the amazing leverage it affords. If you can buy a rental property with 20% down, borrowing 80% from someone else, and if you can manage to cover the mortgage and all your expenses out of the rent, way harder than many people imagine, especially if the roof one day needs to be replaced, and if, what with inflation and all, you can someday sell it for twice what you paid, you have not doubled your money. You have multiplied it sixfold, before tax anyway, and if it was your own home, there could well be no tax. Right? You put down $40,000 on a $200,000 property, broke even on expenses, or paid no more to own your home than you would have paid in rent, in this example, and sold for $400,000, leaving you with $240,000 after paying off the mortgage, six times what you started with. I'm oversimplifying, but you get the point. Many of the greatest fortunes, and millions of small ones, have been built on real estate. But leverage works both ways, as many investors and speculators and home buyers discovered when they got caught up in the real estate bubble. The very modest home next to mine that sold for $105,000 in 1998 fetched $765,000 in 2005. Can you imagine? Then traded hands in 2010 in foreclosure at $265,000. So buy only when the numbers really work. And recognize that owning rental properties isn't an investment, it's a business. That's fine if you have the time, talent, and temperament. But it's sure a lot easier to pick up the phone and buy 1,000 shares of a company that invests in real estate, such as a real estate investment trust listed on the New York Stock Exchange, than to fix a tenant's toilet on a Sunday morning. Easier still to pick up the phone and sell those 1,000 shares than to sell your building. Real estate, indeed, can be as much a part-time job, scouting for properties, arranging their purchase, fixing them up, interviewing tenants, keeping them happy, negotiating the bureaucratic maze, cajoling plumbers and emergencies, as an investment. Some people see only headaches and risks. Others see a chance to be creative, to build sizable equity and even more sizable bank debt, and to run their own show. If you are one of the latter, there are a great many primers available, not to mention eager real estate brokers who may go so far as to offer to manage your properties for you for a percentage of the rent. By all means, buy that seaside motel as your semi-retirement home and business. But recognize that that's what it is, a business, and that running a business is a job, and that not all real estate does appreciate. Don't expect a four-bedroom house to grow to make you rich. At the end of the day, it hasn't grown at all. It's still a four-bedroom house. Your own business. There are thousands of businesses besides real estate to go into. Among the potential tax advantages, you could get rich. But it's a huge undertaking, and another book. This book is about your money, not about switching careers. Your own home. You can't depreciate it. You don't even get any tax benefit if you wind up selling it at a loss, as you do with investments. But the higher your tax bracket, the more of the cost Uncle Sam shoulders by virtue of the tax deductions home ownership provides for mortgage interest and property tax. Meanwhile, paying off the mortgage provides a good method of forced saving, as your equity builds month by month, albeit imperceptibly at first. Perhaps best of all, any gain when you sell your primary residence is tax-free up to $250,000, $500,000 for a married couple, as long as you lived there for at least 2 of the previous 5 years before the sale. Stocks. Growing companies pay out little or nothing in the way of taxable dividends. Most of their profits are reinvested, and most of your return, it is hoped, will come in the form of long-term appreciation. The first advantage, tax on your gains is deferred until you actually choose to sell and take your profit. In the meantime, Uncle Sam's share of your capital is working for you alongside your own. The second advantage, long-term capital gains and qualifying dividends, those paid by corporations subject to corporate income tax, are taxed less heavily than ordinary income. Timber. Not timber, as the loggers warn at the top of their lungs, but rather timber in vaguely the same way Dustin Hoffman encountered plastics in that famous scene in The Graduate, but with a tax advantage. I claim no expertise in timber, yet feel comfortable suggesting that you consider putting 5% or 10% of your long-term funds in it if the price is right. I arrive at this conclusion because people who actually do know something about timber think this makes some sense. Timber, for starters, grows. Gold doesn't. Copper doesn't. Pork bellies and sorghum do, but you have to feed the pork and fertilize the sorghum. I think. I'm actually not sure what sorghum is. Trees are fed by God. And as they grow, they not only become bigger, that much you knew, they become more valuable. Skinny trees may be suitable for conversion to paper or wood chips or something, but as they grow thicker, they gradually become more highly prized for their usefulness in building things. So, the first thing is that where most inventory actually shrinks, either because it spoils or because some of it walks out the door with the occasional larcenous employee, timber just sits there and grows more valuable. Don't ask me how fast, but you might imagine 5% a year between actual growth and the growth in value as it becomes suitable for boardroom tabletops. Then you have what I've been told is perhaps a 2% annual unpopularity bonus. That is to say, the market allows you a higher return on your money than it should because people are quite skittish about investing in trees. Leave aside the sheer boredom of it, I'm talking here of the obvious negatives. Fire, blight, the increasing irrelevance of paper in a world of pixels. It turns out, these fears may be overdone. The wise forest manager diversifies geographically and by species, so that the risks from fire and disease are mitigated. And while wood is undoubtedly the most substituted for material on Earth, we are constantly finding other materials to replace it, it seems to grow ever more valuable. With ups and downs, to be sure, but on a general 2% annual long-term trend line. That long trend could always end or go into reverse, but it might not. Think, for example, of a billion or more Chinese and Indians who don't now have decent houses, but might someday be ready to build. That's a lot of wood. So you get the growth of the inventory and its gradual seasoning to more valuable uses. You get what may be a slow but very long-term increase in the value of wood products, generally. And you get the same sort of unpopularity premium you might have gotten investing in Philip Morris all these years, without having to feel in any way responsible for helping to addict young children to the world's leading cause of preventable death. There is a large anti-tobacco contingent. Few people are anti-tree. Yes, there could be times when timber prices fall sharply and remain depressed. But you don't have to sell until you want to. While you wait for the price to recover, your timber just keeps growing. Contrast that with an airline seat or hotel room that, if unsold tomorrow, is gone forever. And there's more. For one thing, timber should be a good inflation hedge over the long run. For another, properly managed, income from timber should be lightly taxed. If you cut and sell some trees, Uncle Sam generally views the revenue not as a taxable dividend, but as a return of capital, or at least he does until you've sold off most of the trees you started with. At that point, you can sell your forest for a lightly taxed capital gain. But how are you, who not that many years ago paid off your last student loan, going to buy a forest? One way, if you have a great deal of money, is to lock up a small fortune in a timber partnership. But an equally good way, accessible to more or less anyone, may be to buy shares in companies like Weyerhaeuser, WY, most recently at around $32 a share. These days it yields nearly 4%. That ain't hay. Hay rots when it gets wet. And over time, the dividend, and with it the stock price, could rise to match or even outpace inflation. Two similar stocks to consider: Potlatch, PCH, and Rayonier, RYN. Until this edition, I was using Plum Creek Lumber, PCL, as my suggestion. But guess what? After decades of decent payouts, and after trading around $35 for quite a while, as I noted in the 2010 edition, Weyerhaeuser is in the process of acquiring it, as I write, for about $50 a share. You could also buy either of two exchange-traded funds with the clever symbols CUT and WOOD, giving you broad diversification. But you pay an annual management fee. Perhaps check to see which stocks they own and each year diversify over different timber stocks, but also over time by not investing all at once, directly buying shares in a new stock each year. You're 24 and have $3,800 to invest? Forget timber. You'll die of boredom. But if you're 50 and have accumulated $700,000 to help hold you from age 70 on through 95, gradually accumulating a timber portfolio this way with 5% or 10% of your assets could make sense. One caveat: there are no sure things. Anything can blow up somehow. Don't put more than 5% or 10% into timber. Charity. If you write large checks to charity each year, you can save a lot of money in taxes by giving appreciated securities instead. Not only do you get the tax deduction for the gift, you avoid the capital gains tax that otherwise would have been due upon sale of the securities. In the case of a stock you bought for $4,000 that's now worth $13,500, you could save upward of $1,500 in federal and state capital gains tax. But be careful. Be certain to have your broker transfer the stock to the charity before she sells it and sends the charity the proceeds. If the stock is held in your name when it's sold, you pay the tax. Be certain you've held the shares, or the building, or the Van Gogh, at least a year and a day, or the IRS will allow you to deduct only your original cost. Of course, this doesn't make sense for small gifts. Too much hassle for both you and the charity to arrange for the transfer of, say, $250 or $500 worth of Apple. But if you're someone who likes to give $100 or $250 a year to a dozen different charities, there's a solution. Open an account with the Fidelity Investments Charitable Gift Fund, fidelitycharitable.org. Transfer your $13,500 worth of stock to that account, for which you get an immediate charitable deduction, just as if you'd given it to the Red Cross. Then, from time to time, visit Fidelity's website to issue your instructions. If it's a charity you've given to before, it takes just a few clicks. Fidelity will send checks on your behalf as small as $50, investing the balance in the meantime in your choice of funds, so you may have even more to give away if those funds grow than you planned. This is the poor man's way to set up a charitable foundation: the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and now your foundation. Fidelity's gift fund is also handy if you should get a windfall. Say you exercised the last of your Google stock options this year and reaped $400,000, of which you'd like to give $100,000 to charity. The charitable gift fund could be perfect. After all, there you are, a 42-year-old receptionist who just happened to be with Google from the beginning. If you gave all $100,000 to your favorite charities this year, you'd be showered with love and appreciation, and deluged with requests next year. But what could you give next year? You're still a receptionist, albeit a darned good one, and you make $46,000 a year. But suddenly the people you gave $5,000 to last year are expecting $6,000 this year, and you were thinking more along the lines of $50, which for a guy or gal making $46,000 is a very nice gift. They'll hate you. With $100,000 in the gift fund, you might decide to distribute $5,000 a year out of the growth in the fund itself, with any luck, perhaps never dipping into the $100,000 at all. That way, you are perceived as a very generous person indeed. How many receptionists give away $5,000 a year? And can enjoy and refine your giving over the years without undue stress. Vanguard, vanguardcharitable.org, and Schwab, schwabcharitable.org, have charitable gift funds that work the same way. Charitable fine points. If you've given $250 or more to a charity, you'll need a receipt, not just your canceled check. Most charities send them automatically, since they are well aware of the regulation, but it's your responsibility to get them and keep them if you're ever audited. It's not good enough to get them a year or two later when the audit notice comes. The receipts must be dated no later than the date you file the tax return claiming them as deductions. One more reason to use the charitable gift fund instead. They keep all the paperwork for you, basically, except for the occasional receipt you'll get for the bulk amount you give them. Receipts are supposed to make clear that you received nothing of significant value in return for your contribution, or else disclose the fair value of what you did receive, e.g., $40 of your $150 benefit ticket went for food and entertainment. You only get to deduct $110, even if you have witnesses who will swear you ate just one dinner roll. If you give something other than cash, the charity is expected to provide only a description of the goods, not an estimate of their fair market, flea market value. That's your job. If you're giving something other than marketable securities valued above $5,000, an appraisal is usually required. Testimony from your aunt who knows antiques, gorgeous, will not do it. If you go to a charity auction and buy a Warhol print, or the actual Bic used by Paul Simon to pen Bridge Over Troubled Water, you are entitled to deduct only that portion of your check, if any, that exceeds the fair market value of what you purchased. So if the estimate in the auction catalog is $1,500 and you snag it for $900, you get no charitable deduction. A lot of people take the full amount of the check as a deduction anyway, which is probably one of the reasons the IRS now requires receipts of the type mentioned before. 50-some years ago, my mother organized a very successful art auction in our barn. I know you wouldn't expect this from a city boy like me, but we had a barn. It raised a few $1,000s for some worthy cause, and my father, knowing that most of the successful bidders were likely to write off 100% of their expenditures as charitable deductions, dubbed the event La Grande Taxe d'Argerie. I think he dubbed it in French so as not to corrupt the children, much as we used to talk about feeding the DOG so as not to excite the dog. Just as it's rarely wise to invest in something brought to your attention by bulk mail, so is it risky to give money to a charity based on a slick or plaintive solicitation, let alone to a telemarketer calling on behalf of some charity over the phone, and keeping, often, 50% or more of your donation. One of the more remarkable examples was a group that granted the wishes of dying children. According to the New York Times, the group raised $237,000 in 1984. Of that, $10,000 went to grant wishes. The rest was spent on professional fundraising organizations salaries, car rentals, jewelry, rent, unsecured personal loans, a VCR, and a videotape entitled Sex Games. Such things resurface frequently. Visit give.org to check out your investment in a charity, much as you would check out your investment in a stock. Charity and your IRA. If you're planning to leave some money to charity when you die, and you have a traditional IRA or KEO plan, consider naming the charities as the plan's beneficiaries. That will save the income tax your heirs would otherwise have had to pay on it. Give your heirs regular money from outside your IRA instead, money on which income tax has already been paid. To the charities, it won't make any difference. Charities don't pay taxes. But to your heirs, it will. Charity and your fortune. If you have no heirs that you're dying to leave money to, check out Fidelity Investments' Pooled Income Fund, fidelitycharitable.org. You get a tax deduction for the present value of your contribution, and you get an income for life. When you die, what's left goes to the charities of your choice. Something's present value depends on how long you have to wait for it. If I offered you $1,000 tomorrow in return for $900 today, and you trusted me, I'll bet you'd give me the $900. But for that same $1,000 6 years from now, you'd likely offer less. The further off the payout, the lower its present value. The amount of the tax deduction you get from a gift like this depends on your age. If you're 85, the present value the IRS assigns your gift is nearly as high as the gift itself, because the IRS doesn't realize you're one of those phenomena who are going to be playing tennis at 102. If you're 50, there's no point bothering with this, because the present value of your gift will be tiny. If you have a ton of dough, you might not want to pool your money with others' money. Theirs might be new money, entirely unsuitable to socialize with yours. You would set up your own charitable remainder trust. Almost any large charity will eagerly walk you through the basics of that, after which you might discuss it with your accountant and the attorney who prepared your will. Alternative minimum tax and stock options. This tax was created to keep crafty rich folks from slipping by unscathed. It now often hits middle-class families doing little or nothing out of the ordinary, especially those living in high-tax states, because state and local income taxes, though deductible against ordinary income tax, are among the items not deductible in figuring the alternative minimum tax. Beyond Advil, there's not much defense against the AMT. If you invest in tax-free municipal bonds, make sure they aren't private activity bonds, which are included in income for AMT purposes. If you are going to have a single year of very large income, perhaps from exercising employee stock options, prepay your state and local taxes before the end of the year, so they count as deductions against that high income. Otherwise, they'll count against next year's not-so-high income, only to be knocked out by the AMT. Speaking of employee stock options, when you exercise them, sell the stock immediately. Some people hold on to stock they receive from exercising incentive stock options because they were told they could postpone tax until the shares were sold. But for AMT purposes, the excess of the fair market value of the stock over the exercise price is included in income immediately, and you will owe these taxes even if the stock you hold collapses. That's what happened to a horde of Silicon Valley option millionaires who exercised incentive stock options in early 2000, planning to hold the stock a year and a day to get long-term gains treatment, only to see their holdings vaporize. But their alternative minimum tax bills remain huge. Tax books and software. Whatever the shape of the tax code by the time you listen to this, there will almost surely be a current edition of J.K. Lasser's your income tax to guide you through it. Just look in the index for what you need. Online, visit fairmark.com to get tax answers. But if you're an ordinary person, you won't need any of that. Just buy H&R Block's tax software, formerly TaxCut, the one I've long used, not least because my face used to be on the box, or TurboTax or TaxAct to prepare your taxes. For simple returns, their free online versions may suffice. It's easy, and you can always go to your accountant the first time to have her check over what you've done. Or, if your tax situation is complex, let the accountant keep doing your taxes, but use these programs to check her work. I once found a $2,000 error my mom's excellent accountant made in the IRS's favor. Nobody's perfect. Part 2. The stock market. The problem with trying to beat the market is that professional investors are so talented, so numerous, and so dedicated to their work that as a group they make it very difficult for any one of their number to do significantly better than the others, particularly in the long run. It is so easy, while trying to do better, to do worse. Charles D. Ellis, Investment Policy, How to Win the Loser's Game. 7. Meanwhile, down at the track. October. This is one of the particularly dangerous months to speculate in stocks. Others are November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, and September. Mark Twain. Okay. You have some money in a savings bank. You are contributing to your company's 401k at the maximum rate allowed. You have equity in a home if you want it. You've tied up $1,000 in bulk purchases of tuna fish and shaving cream. You have lowered your auto and homeowners insurance premiums by increasing your deductibles. You have adequate term life insurance. You've paid off all your 18% installment loans and insulated your attic. You have done, in short, all the things that scream to be done. Now what? There are three compelling reasons to invest a large portion of your remaining funds in stocks. 1. Unlike bonds, stocks offer at least the potential of keeping up with inflation, even if that potential is by no means always realized. Once the interest rate on a bond is set, it's set. Well, leaving aside the special inflation-protected treasury securities described in Chapter 5. Bread could go to $20 a loaf, and the bond wouldn't pay a nickel more in interest. But the company that bakes the bread might be able to keep its profits and its dividend rising in step with inflation. 2. Over the long run, and it may be a very long run, stocks will outperform safer investments. The reason is that stock and bond prices are set in the open market, and the market, over the long run, rewards risk. From 1926 to 2015, according to Ibbotson Associates, who track these sorts of things, the total compounded annual rate of return you would have had from buying risk-free United States Treasury bills was 3.7%. The return from slightly riskier corporate bonds would have been 5.9%. The return from blue-chip stocks would have been 9.8%. And the return from the stocks of small companies would have been even higher, although there is some controversy over the way the small stock figures are arrived at. The compounded annual rate of inflation during the same period was 3%. Ignoring taxes, $1,000 invested in treasury bills over that time span would have grown to $20,530, but to $118,630 in corporate bonds, $2,591,820 in large stocks, and even more in small stocks. Of course, you can play with numbers like these, depending on the time periods you choose. There were some pretty dreadful 5- and 10-year stretches nestled in among those 90 years, in case you hadn't noticed, during which you would have been much better off in bonds or even a savings account. There was, for example, the period from September 1929 to June 1932, during which the U.S. stock market dropped 83%. Smaller stocks fared even worse, losing 92% of their value. If that seems like ancient history, large stocks lost 43% between January 1973 and September 1974, and small stocks were clobbered by more than 70% in the 6 years from late 1968 to late 1974, the first 6 years of my own investing career, which has made me rather cautious ever since. More recently, you may have noticed slippage in the NASDAQ index from 5,049 in March of 2000 to 1,114 in October of 2002, a stumble of nearly 78%. In part, that was because the NASDAQ was dominated by a relative handful of high-tech bubble stocks. But even the more representative Standard & Poor's 500 index was down 50%. Between October 2007 and March 2009, the most recent period when the world was about to come to an end, the global stock market pretty much collapsed. The S&P 500 dropped 55%. But time heals all wounds. When the New York Stock Exchange celebrated its 200th birthday in May 1992, it could report that a person who bought shares in all of the companies on the exchange on any day in its history would have made a profit of over any 15-year stretch and would have beaten bonds and savings accounts over virtually any period exceeding 20 years. Wharton finance professor Jeremy Siegel actually managed to come up with data for stock and bond performance stretching all the way back to 1802. A single dollar invested in stocks would have grown to $12.7 million or so by 2006, he concluded, 8.3% a year compounded. After inflation, a mere $755,000. After taxes, at the maximum rate, and inflation, an almost pathetic $30,000. In truth, the tax hit would have been much smaller since he assumed annual taxation, while a buy-and-hold investor would only have paid annual taxes on the dividend distributions. The same dollar invested in safer long-term government bonds, after taxes and inflation, would have been worth $97. And the interest on the bonds would have been taxed each year. An investor in the maximum tax bracket might have invested in municipal bonds instead and wound up with $577, but that's still a far cry from $30,000. Obviously, for the long run, it is no contest between stocks and bonds. Not surprisingly, Jeremy Siegel is the author of Stocks for the Long Run. Will the American economy be as dynamic over the next couple of centuries? It could be. So now the only problems are A, to be sure to set aside that dollar, and B, somehow to remain spry long enough to enjoy it. When this book was revised in 1983, things had recently been dismal. Inflation nearing 20%, unemployment topping 10%, and the widespread conviction that every car on the road would soon be made in Japan. Yet it seemed, as I wrote then, that it just might be that we have been going through a toughening up process over the last several years, and that our sensational technological prowess has been paving the way for enormous strides forward. The stock market quadrupled in the 12 years that followed. Here's what I wrote in the 1995 revision following that rise. Technology races ahead faster than ever, a tremendous force for productivity and prosperity. And where for decades the defense budget siphoned off around 6% of our gross domestic output, compared with 1% for the Japanese, a huge competitive disadvantage, today that largely non-productive spending has dropped to more like 3.5%. At the same time, there's been a sweeping worldwide movement toward free trade and capitalism. Considering these broad forces, the heights to which the U.S. stock market had risen by 1995, while scary, were not totally unfounded. It was not, by and large, a bubble. Specific stocks may collapse. I can think of a few candidates. But the overall market, no matter where it goes from here, will, over the long run, go much higher. All that remains true, I subsequently wrote in the 1998 edition, and defense spending is now under 3% of our gross domestic product. Stocks have soared since 1995, leaving me all the more nervous for the short run. But the future holds great promise. The eternal question when times are good and hopes bright, how much of that promise is already reflected in stock prices? And what if things go wrong? When the next real bear market comes, it's likely to be a killer, because so few investors or money managers today have ever really lived through one. But guess what? If you hang in there and invest more as the fainter-hearted panic and prices grind steadily lower month after excruciating month, in the long run, you'll do just fine. In the next revision, this is the only investment guide you will ever need so long as the world never changes, in 2002, I noted, "We seem to have entered that killer bear market. What else would you call a 70% drop in the NASDAQ?" By the time you read this, the pain may be over, or not. But the greater the pain, the greater the ultimate opportunity. In the 2005 revision, I added, "The bear market finally ended about a year later, and the broad market soared around 50% over the next 15 months, and the NASDAQ was up 94%. And so I am nervous again. I am dismayed by the re-election of George Bush. Yes, my taxes are likely to stay low, but I don't see how we become more prosperous if much of the world hates us, if we are adding to our national debt at a tremendous rate, if we are investing in missile systems instead of education, if we are giving tax incentives to encourage the purchase of Hummers rather than fuel efficiency. And that just begins the list. As I write this, stock and real estate prices do not seem to me to reflect all the challenges. As it happened, the stock market crashed in 2008 from a high of 14,165 on the Dow to a low in March 2009 of 6,500. With its having recovered to 10,000 by the time of the last edition in 2010, I wrote that, by staying cautious, you might sidestep the next 40% drop in the market. But you could also miss the next impressive gains. If you're able to take the long view, a program of steady investments in the stock market is wise indeed, no matter where the market is when you start. And that's still true. If you're looking out 40 years, famed investor John Marks Templeton told Mutual Funds magazine in early 1995, "I think you can probably do 15% a year. The short-term outlook is not as rosy," he said, "because we're coming off such a rapid run-up already." And that was 1995, when the Dow was at 4,000. A strong reason is that progress is speeding up. The improvements in most companies and industries are coming faster and faster. It's been an absolutely marvelous time to live. Just in my 82-year lifetime, the world standard of living has quadrupled, and that's amazing. Through history, it took 1,000 years to double the standard of living. The reasons why it is speeding up have not stopped. In fact, they've speeded up. Take the amount of money spent on scientific research. 82 years ago, the world spent about $1 billion every 3 months. Now the world is spending $2 billion a day. I buy that, and I don't. It's one thing for stocks to grow spectacularly from 1982, when the Dow was wildly undervalued, if the world didn't end, at 777, and long-term interest rates, anticipating terrible inflation, were 15%. But with the Dow having topped 18,000 in 2015 and long-term rates more like 3%, the pendulum had swung. As noted previously, It was the spectacular decline in interest rates that powered much of the spectacular rise in stock and bond values. Where will interest rates go now? With luck, we've learned enough lessons about inflation and the way budget deficits stoke it and free trade restrains it to avoid driving interest rates back up too far, and have enough lingering memory of the Depression to avoid something catastrophic that would drive them down much further. The market won't go to zero. But investors need to understand that in a really, really bad economy, which I do not expect, share prices of many businesses can go essentially to zero without those businesses closing their doors. They just get new owners. Unable to make good on their bond payments, the current owners, shareholders, basically have to hand ownership over to the bondholders. So, especially if you have a lot of eggs, think twice before putting them all in the stock market basket. One final thought is that the new economy is great for consumers, but not necessarily for investors. I am thrilled by what I can do on the internet and the way I can use it to find the best prices. But price competition, while great for consumers, is murder on investors. So you know what? It may turn out to be a brave new world, yet the same very tough, challenging stock market it always was. Rewarding over time, but no pushover. The rewards remain real, but so do the risks. 3. If all goes well, stocks can act as a tax shelter. Long-term capital gains are generally taxed less heavily than ordinary income, and no tax is due on your gains until you choose to take them. Only the dividends face immediate taxation. Because many companies pay out relatively little of their profits in dividends, you pay relatively little tax on your share of those profits. Instead, the company retains and reinvests them for you. If they do a good job, future profits and your share of them will be even larger. This is the bird-in-the-bush strategy of investing. With it, you can ultimately profit two ways. First, after a period of years, the company may decide to pay out a greater portion of its, by then fatter, profits as dividends. Second, you can sell your stock. If the company has invested your profits wisely, there is a reasonable chance you will get more for it than you paid, perhaps even several times as much. It thus becomes a matter of some interest just how well a company is likely to reinvest all those profits they don't pay you as dividends. Unfortunately, there is no way to know for sure. However, you can determine how well they've done, or, because accounting is open to so much qualification and interpretation, how well they seem to have done in the past. The number you are looking for is return on equity, and it is simply the company's profits expressed as a percentage of all the money shareholders have dumped in over the years, much of it by foregoing dividends. There are companies that have been able to reinvest those accumulated unpaid dividends at returns well above 15% a year. Others have earned less than half as much. And then there are those that have diddled it away altogether. Investors would naturally prefer stock in companies more like the former than the latter, all other things being equal. So all other things are not equal. You have to pay more for stock in companies that are known to reinvest profits at a high rate of return. Indeed, there was a time, 1973, when you had to pay $60 or more to get a $1 slice of Avon's profit pie. So excited were investors by Avon's ability to earn 25% on that dollar. At the same time, it cost only $8 to buy a $1 slice of Goodrich's slower-growing profit pie. What investors failed to note was that, although 25% was a boffo return on that one reinvested Avon dollar, a dollar, no matter how well it was reinvested, was a pretty lousy return on a $60 investment. Subsequently, Avon stock fell about 85%, even though profits kept growing. So there's more to choosing the right stock than finding the company with the highest return on equity. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I should not talk like this until you know as much about the essentials of the stock market, the forest, as the professionals do. This will take up most of the rest of the chapter. Getting to know as much about the trees could take up most of the rest of your life. The stock market could hardly be simpler. There are just two ways a stock can go, up or down. There are just two emotions that tug in those opposite directions, greed and fear. There are just two ways to make money on a stock, dividends and capital gains. And there are just two kinds of investors in the market, the public, like you or me, and the institutions, like mutual funds and pension funds, and, cue the scary music, hedge funds. It's the amateurs against the professionals, and it's not all that clear who has the advantage. Often, both lose. The bottom line, if you want to cut straight to the chase, is that most people should do their stock market investing through no-load index funds, mutual funds that don't attempt to actively pick the best stocks, but just passively invest in all the stocks in the index they are designed to match, or else through the index funds. If you do, you will outperform at least 90% of all your friends and neighbors, including many who work much harder at this than you. But if you decide to go it alone, either because you believe you can beat the pros or because it's fun to try, listen on. What is a stock worth? Market veterans will tell you that a stock is worth whatever people are willing to pay for it. Price is determined by supply and demand. If lots of people want it, it will be worth a lot. If everyone ignores it, it won't be worth spit. But it is too simple to say that a stock is worth whatever people will pay for it, because what people are willing to pay for it depends on what they think it's worth. It is a circular definition, used as a rationalization of financial foolishness rather than as a rational way to appraise value. The value of a stock should not be nearly so subjective as, say, the value of a Picasso sketch. A share of stock merely entitles the owner to a share of present and future profits, or, in the event of bankruptcy or acquisition by another company, assets. Where two paintings of equal size may reasonably command vastly different values, two companies of equal profits, assets, and prospects should not, yet do. The market veteran will readily agree that this is irrational, but he will ask you, with a laugh, whoever said the stock market was rational? That gets the market veteran off the hook and may eliminate in his mind the need to search for value. But there are other market veterans, perhaps even a majority by now, who believe that rationality does pay off in the market over the long run. Sooner or later, they say, bubbles burst. Sooner or later, bargains are recognized. A company cannot prosper forever without its shareholders at some point benefiting. Indeed, if the market is driven by irrational greed and fear to excesses of over- and undervaluation, as it surely is, then it is the rational man, they say, seeing these excesses for what they are, who will be buying the excessively undervalued stock, particularly when the market as a whole is depressed, and selling the excessively overvalued stock, particularly when the market as a whole is flying high. Thus, may he profit from the swings in between. All of this assumes that a rational man can determine what a stock is really worth. Rational men differ. A company's future prospects, and even its current profits, are open to widely differing assessments. Obviously, no one can answer precisely what a stock is worth. But that doesn't eliminate the need to arrive at some rational valuation or the possibility of setting some reasonable guidelines for doing so. What a stock is worth depends at any given time on the alternative investments that are then available. It is a question of relative value. Think of investments as wallets. A 2% savings account is a wallet you can buy for $50 that miraculously fills up with $1, 2%, by the end of every year. It is safe and convenient. You can sell it whenever you want and be sure of getting back your full $50. But it's not necessarily a great investment if, when savings accounts are paying 2%, you can buy other wallets that fill up with the same $1 just as fast, not for $50, but for a mere $20. For example, high-grade corporate bonds that pay 5% interest. You can say that the first wallet sells for 50 times earnings, and the second for 20 times earnings. This is the famous price-earnings ratio, or multiple, you have heard so much about, although it's generally applied to stocks, not bonds or wallets. Now, if a nearly risk-free investment like a high-grade bond sells for 20 times earnings, what should a stock sell for? On the one hand, a stock should sell for less because it involves more risk. There is no guarantee that the $1 will show up in the wallet by the end of the year, or even that the wallet itself will be in any shape to be sold to someone else should you want to do so. What's more, only a portion of your $1 is actually paid out to you as a cash dividend. Much, most, or all of it may be retained by the company. So really, stocks should sell for way below 20 times earnings. On the other hand, a stock should perhaps sell for more because of its greater potential for gain, the earnings and/or stock price could go up, and because of the tax advantages referred to earlier. So really, stocks should sell for way over 20 times earnings. In deciding how much more or less to pay for a stock than the 20 times earnings you might pay for a high-grade bond, or whatever the going rate is at the time you hear this, one weighs the extra risk against the potential for extra return. For shares of a dull company whose earnings over the long run seem about as likely to increase as to fall, where risk and reward about cancel one another out, you might expect to pay 20 times earnings. So if you find such a stock selling for 10 or 12 times earnings, it could look pretty good. For stock in a company whose earnings seem likely to be able to keep pace with inflation, no real growth, that is, but growth in earnings all the same, you might expect to pay more than the 20 times earnings you would pay for a high-grade bond, the earnings of which do not rise with inflation. In fact, some such companies sold at 5 or 6 times earnings back in 1974 and 1982. A bargain? You bet. Finally, for stock in a company whose prospects are really bright, with the possibility of real growth above inflation, of 5% or 10% or even 20% a year for the foreseeable future, you might expect to pay a lot more than 20 times earnings. All other things being equal, that is, if all stocks were selling at 20 times earnings, you would choose only those companies whose earnings were expected to grow the fastest. But the question is not whether a fast-growing company is better than a slow-growing one. Any fool knows that. The question is whether you should pay 35 times earnings for the one or 12 times earnings for the other. Which stock, at any given time, is a better relative value? The real trick and payoff is to find a company selling for 12 times earnings that you think will grow as fast as the one selling for